Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome to Solving the Puzzle with Dr. Datis Karazian, informing you about evidence-based strategies for autoimmune disease, brain health issues, Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, gut health problems, and many other chronic health conditions. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find more information on today's episode and other topics at drknews.com.
The thing that I've noticed over the years teaching courses in functional medicine is I would finish a course and people go, yep, that was a very interesting seminar, great seminar, thank you. I don't know what to do. And I was like, okay, what do you mean? We went over everything you need to do. And what they really were looking for is like a very linear approach. I have this condition, I take this protocol. What they were basically saying is just give me protocols. And that's not really how functional medicine works. Functional medicine isn't just based on diagnosis and then protocols. It's based on what the mechanism is and then trying to address those pathways. Some people that are new, they may have to spend a little time really understanding how to identify dysglycemia and really get it under control. Other people really have to figure out how to really manage dysbiosis with more detail. And that's just the way it is. Every single person learning functional medicine has gone through the exact same frustration, the same thing, and you just have to put yourself in the fire and then try to survive what to do clinically. And over time, you get more and more comfortable and more of the pieces of the puzzle come together. Now, as we discussed in this course related to hormones, just focusing everything on hormones, one of the approaches is hormone replacement therapy. And when you look at hormone replacement therapy and not using hormone replacement therapy, age is one of the key factors. So obviously, the younger the person is, the less likely you're going to use actual HRT therapy. But as an older a person gets, the more likeliness that HRT therapy could have a potential benefit in the person's health. Then you have age groups right in the middle, where obviously the patient will make the call, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate for them, and need some suggestions, work with healthcare practitioners. The worst thing is when you see a 15-year-old, 16-year-old being placed on birth control pills because no one could do a workup and figure out why they have, let's say, abnormal cycles or PMS or whatsoever, other menstrual migraines. And then the person's on birth control pills for all the way into adulthood for 10, 15-something years, which has severe risk associated with it that studies that clearly have shown, and we went over part one. And then there's also the extreme of some people just being completely anti-hormone and not putting, you know, having anyone consider hormones because they're so worried about it leading to health problems and cancers. But hormones can be very protective for people, especially when they have senescence or failure of their endocrine system. There's a point where aging takes place and receptor sites stop responding well and glands stop producing hormones. But tissues like the brain will still need hormones in order to function properly. And if they don't have it, there'll be accelerated neurodegeneration. And tissues like osteoblasts and osteoclasts and bone will need hormones to stay, to keep the structure there. You really want to be open to all these different possibilities. Now, when you look at the hormone replacement model, we know there's all different types of taking it. People will do various approaches with HRT. These are the standard approaches. We know there's definitely a bias in hormones with male and female treatments. The bias being that men actually get like their hormones specifically tested, and conventionally they go on bioidentical testosterone and they get their labs remeasured and it's very precise. And I think part of this has happened really because when they start to really evaluate men, they knew a lot more about hormones and testing and outcomes than with women. With women, like in the 70s, birth control pill was a revolutionary thing. Everyone on the pill is like safe. Everyone can be on it. It's no big deal. And then everyone can just be on Prem and Provera. It's really no big deal. And this effort to really specifically look at hormones, be precise, and use bioidentical never really got adopted into the medical system, conventional system. And there's still a lot of synthetic use without any bioidenticals or even any kind of measurements. And I think most people that practice functional medicine or alternative medicine more have a greater tendency to prefer bioidentical hormones. I think most patients and most people you talk to would always prefer bioidentical. The only time they would even usually consider synthetic is just like when the doctor says, yeah, it's just the same thing. It's all the same. Okay. Thanks, doc. Trust you. Is it really the same? No, it's not. It's different. Okay. And of course, a lot of the synthetic ones convert into bioidentical, but we know that it's not exactly the same. Okay. Now, with hormones, the strengths and weaknesses for the replacement model. And there's always the balance of, are you stimulating any kind of hormone-sensitive cancers? Is that being checked? Is there any clotting issues? Is there any risk for stroke? If you're concerned about a patient having a stroke for if they're on hormones and a risk for clotting and stroke, check their serum fibrinogen levels. Check their prothrombin time. Those can be good clues to see what's happening with them. Any person, once they get into the age where they really need hormones, should be getting regular screening for cancers anyway. The annual physical exam has clearly been found in research studies after to be totally useless. You want to encourage them to get a full body MRI every so many years to just screen for stuff. Looking at liquid biopsy tests for cancers is really a standard approach you probably should consider doing every year if it's affordable. They're like $1,000, or at least every 2 or 3 years. Lots of colon cancer screening tests are now very reliable to look for malignancies with the fecal DNA testing and so forth. These should be done regardless if someone's on hormones or not, but doing hormones too quickly does suppress feedback loops and gland atrophy, and you don't want like a 30-year-old that goes on TRT without taking precautions, and all of a sudden they can't have children because they have testicular atrophy, and whether they can recover from that. So this is the balancing act. Now, we know with the HRT model, really no treatment for any kind of subtle puberty abnormalities, and with menstrual cycle irregularities, oral contraceptives. And then we know with females, HRT. So if females are walking the typical healthcare system, they're going to go on HRT. They'll have the common symptoms. These are all the different types of HRT therapies used. This is a review paper in Nature Reviews, if you're not familiar with what's being used. And a lot of time in the conventional healthcare system, it's going to be, what does their insurance cover? Whatever their insurance covers is what they're going to be placed on. And then in addition to, for perimenopause, transitioning into to the menopause, they may even use different types of antidepressants to support them, and that's a typical approach. Now, I think people start to practice more functional medicine, start to attract patients that don't want that approach. They want a bioidentical approach, and they want to work with a practitioner that's measuring their hormones specifically and doing bioidentical testing. Now, we haven't spent much time with the bioidentical approach, but ultimately, it's not that difficult. You want to be really amazing at doing bioidentical-specific hormones, then work with a good compounding pharmacist. It's really that simple. Everything else is just really time and experience using that. All you basically do is measure all the hormones, see what's low in a postmenopausal patient, and then they can make any kind of formula or cream or drop, and you as a practitioner can have different preferences for different types of hormones. Patient has symptoms, you run labs, work with a good compounding pharmacist. They can do drops, patches, creams, injections for different hormones. And the reality is, if you go to a group of people that practice bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, none of them will agree of how to do it the same way. Some will love creams, some will love patches, some will say injections the only way to do it. Some will talk about having specific variations of different estrogens, estradiols. Some will talk about how often you need to test, and if you don't test that often, you don't know how to do it. There is a lot of strong opinions about this, and I don't want to go there myself. And at the end of the day, if you want to become an expert in this, it's not that hard. Your biggest battle is to first find a good compounding pharmacist, and then you can experiment with different things and try different things. There's always some degree of experimentation with any kind of hormones. You don't know if the dose you're giving them is the right dose, because a lab test number doesn't really mean anything that is going to be specific to you of what dose to start with. You could have a guy that has really low testosterone, and you go, oh, I'm going to give them a really high dose, and they can totally crash and not recover for months because they're not metabolizing it well. So typically the rule of thumb is, with customized approaches, you just see what the levels are, you start with a very low dose, and then from there you work your way up and build up, seeing how they feel, what their symptoms are, some trial and error. So with a customized hormone therapy approach, it's really a lot of testing, remonitoring, reevaluations that take place, symptoms and labs. So you get some basic hormone level, see what the levels are, and then reevaluate. And I would say that when you look at different types of therapies, like injections would typically be ideal for a lot of hormone replacement, because it can be very specific directly in the bloodstream. The dose is very specific. The carriers they use, we know what the half-lives are for different hormones. But it's not commonly used with females because females have to take a spectrum of hormones with males is typically used because males, usually when they go on HRT, they're just basically taking like testosterone and some HCG to counteract the pituitary suppression part of it, testicular suppression of it. With females, though, typically what they do is like oral dosages, or they do little drops and troches and so forth, but those get degraded really quickly, so they have to do them more frequently than other times. Creams are very popular, but creams, they just build up in tissue, they build up in body fat. It's really easy to overdose. And if someone's using creams, they can't touch their children with it, or pets, or their spouses, because those hormones do spread into their tissue very quickly. And if you do any kind of free fraction testing, like saliva testing or serum free testing, you can clearly see, wow, your hormone levels are really high. Are you taking estrogens? No, my wife takes hormones. How does she take them? A cream. Oh, when does she take them? Right before bed. So she rubs it on and you guys sleep next to each other. Yes. Okay, well, you're an HRT also. You just don't know it. Beware of that as well. Typically, bioidentical hormones is not covered by insurance, and not every patient has access to it, and the treatment approaches vary from practitioner to practitioner, not standardized in healthcare. And the focus of this course has really been on diet, nutrition, lifestyle, functional medicine approaches, how to try to improve endocrine function itself, not just the replacement part of it. And even when people have the replacement part of it supported, they're getting a lab test checked and getting a specific formula that's based on the best assumption for their symptoms and lab results for that for them as a patient, they still need to have their dysbiosis corrected so they metabolize their hormones properly. They still need hormone biotransformation. They still need insulin levels under control so it doesn't surge things like aromatase and 1720 lyase and cause all types of disruptions. They still need their adipokines under control so it doesn't disrupt their hormone endocrine feedback loops. It's not like replacement alone is going to fix everything. The body has to still metabolize and use the hormones that they're taking in a customized protocol into their physiology and how it's converted and how it's metabolized as well too. So everything, other things all still apply. Now, when we get into men with testosterone replacement therapy, let's talk about this. This is definitely something that is underutilized in healthcare systems. Testosterone has profound effects on the brain in males. Biggest clinical indication that someone is low on testosterone is they lose their libido, they lose morning erections, and then along with that, they get depression and mood issues, and then their lipid panels start to become abnormal. And it's much easier for them to gain body fat, and it's much harder for them to gain muscle mass. Those things happen, but they happen slowly and gradually over time. There isn't this sharp decline, so it's really hard to notice the effect, right? It's like the analogy of something being cooked in water that's getting hot over and over time. The water's slowly getting hot and hot. Before you know it, it's, you know, you're dead in the hot water and cooked, but it's so slow you don't notice it. Same thing with testosterone levels dropping in men. Now, when you look at some of the research here, there's this really very powerful relationship between testosterone and body mass index. Remember, body mass, especially body fat, it can totally disrupt endocrine function as well. You can get into this vicious cycle of abnormalities where testosterone levels drops, there's increased body fat, then creates inflammatory adipokine reactions that then damage lytic testicular cell function to get in this pattern. But testosterone therapy has been shown to really make a big difference with that. This was a paper, it was a review paper, Testosterone and Weight Loss, the Evidence, and it goes on to say that we propose that testosterone therapy in obese men with testosterone deficiency offers a well-tolerated and effective therapy and produces sustained and significant weight loss. Testosterone therapy increases lean body mass, reduces fat mass, and produces sustained and significant weight loss reduction in waist circumference and BMI. This was a review of all these papers published. You can see some were done for 9 months, some were done for 36 months, some were done for 3 months. But they pretty much all show, all these studies that looked at body composition with testosterone, they all showed an increased lean body mass, anywhere, even the ones with only 3 months. And they all showed decrease in fat mass, like every single one. So this isn't like cherry picking. So when you're looking at the effects of testosterone, testosterone has some major impacts on body composition that's summarized here. When you look at the testosterone, first of all, it enhances glucose utilization. So the main pathways where glucose is utilized is your muscular pathways. And actually the biggest receptor sites where you have insulin resistance problems with, the tissue we have the greatest issue with insulin sensitivity is really muscles. So the testosterone immediately enhances glucose utilization. That's why also when men or women have low testosterone patterns, they just feel like they don't have good recovery, they don't have much endurance when they exercise and work out. So one of the ways testosterone works in both men and females is it enhances glucose utilization, it decreases upregulation of testosterone, so testosterone is not being converted into estrogens, so it has that effect. Now, you can still have some of this with more insulin and more body fat, but it has some protective effects there. And as insulin levels go down, there's less upregulation of aromatase. As insulin levels go down, there's decreased inflammatory cytokines. Testosterone itself has an anti-inflammatory effect in both men and women. When women have testosterone levels that are spiking too high, that will actually promote androgen deficiency. But low testosterone in females can also lead to similar problems that you see with low testosterone males related to muscle function and insulin and utilization. Now, testosterone promotes myogenesis, muscle mass, so they can increase their lean muscle mass. More muscles you have, more myokines you have. And then as people get more men, typically they have low testosterone, they finally get the testosterone levels restored. It's much easier for them to exercise and work out. It's easier for them to recover. And when their testosterone levels are low, like even when they try to work out and exercise, it's just difficult for them. And a lot of men with dysfunction in their testosterone-related pathways to muscle bioenergetics will have like sore muscles all the time. Muscles will always be tight. Nothing lets them let go. They're always having to stretch and use like a foam roller, and they're just sore. Then they go and work out, and they get tightened up all the time, and they're going, oh, getting old sucks. It's not getting old. Your tissues don't have the hormones it needs to function to produce energy. That's really what this comes down to. And then testosterone promotes mitochondrial biogenesis. They can have more energy, activates lipoxidation, so it helps the pathways to burn body fat. So increased testosterone in men has been found clearly to change lean body mass, reduce body fat, mitochondria, mitochondrial insulin sensitivity, and reduce inflammatory cytokines. Now, it's not going to be the magic bullet for everything. If a male has issues related to other variables and stressors, like cortisol is really high all the time, doesn't mean testosterone is going to fix everything. You could have multiple variables impacting anything. But one of the variables that testosterone has is these impacts on increasing muscle mass, decreasing body fat. But it's not the only thing. For example, you could have a male that has a hypothyroid condition. And even though they're taking testosterone, they're still not getting the changes because it's not exclusively testosterone that's impacting their pathways. Okay? This was a really interesting study, effects of lifelong testosterone exposure on health and disease using Mendelian randomization. So this was a study they did with free testosterone levels in 161,268 males in the UK and looking at 461 health outcomes. And what they did was they didn't measure if they were on testosterone replacement therapy. This is nothing with therapy. They were just measuring people in the population in this biobank and what is their circulating free testosterone levels, and what kind of health outcomes do they have. So they refer to this as natural testosterone, lifelong natural testosterone. They go on to show that the Mendelian randomization analysis made it possible to examine the effects of lifelong naturally elevated testosterone levels in 469 traits and diseases. And they found that testosterone increased the density of bone mineral and decreased body fat. However, it also increased the risk of prostate cancer, high blood pressure, baldness conditions, and affect the spine. So they have more bone growth, more bone for stenosis of the spine, more patterns of androgenic alopecia, hair loss. But overall, like the bone mineral density was improved. And when you look at these lifelong patterns, and that if you get a chance, this is in your course material, you can see overall has general health indications. And very clear relationship. The higher the testosterone levels were, the more lean body mass they had. It was much easier for them to have healthy metabolism. When you see individuals, especially men, that always have really good metabolism, lean body mass, they usually naturally have very high levels of testosterone. So let's say that testosterone range is somewhere between 400 to 950, let's say 400 to 1,000. There's some men circulating around with levels of 800 all the time. And those men usually recover really well. They're usually really fit. They have really no difficulty losing body fat. And then genetically, there's some men that have lower testosterone levels all the time. They don't ever really get to that higher level. And they may have a harder time getting lean muscle mass and burning body fat. Okay. Now, here's a summary of charts, different types of testosterone, oral testosterone pellets, topical that can be used. And by the way, in that one study where they looked at 49 health outcomes in men that were on just their own testosterone levels throughout a lifespan, they really did find that they had reduced inflammation, reduced cardiovascular risk markers, and blood pressure was much better with them, and so forth. Okay, this is a paper looking at insulin-resistant inflammation hypogonad men. And they took 94 men to type 2 diabetes. They were recruited for the study. 50 men were eugonadal, meaning their hypogonadism, basically. 44, I mean they didn't have hypogonadism. 44 had hypogonadism. And then they were placed on testosterone replacement therapy intramuscularly. And testosterone treatment in men with type 2 diabetes and hypogonadism increased insulin sensitivity, increased lean body mass, and decreased subcutaneous fat. They go on to say, like, why aren't all these men with type 2 diabetes that are struggling have their testosterone levels checked, and if they're low, get treatment? Because it can completely reverse some of these major factors that are so hard to change with them. If you're working with patients that have diabetes, you definitely want to check their testosterone levels, males with diabetes. This is a study of 13 randomized clinical trials of 5,000 subjects. And they were looking at the safety issues with testosterone, because testosterone has this, bioidentical testosterone is concerned for people because they want to know if it has the same effects that steroids have with some of these bodybuilders that have abused it for a long period of time. So in this large systematic review meta-analysis, they found that testosterone replacement therapy is not associated with risk of things like venous thromboembolism. This was another study that was done to looking at the potential risk for testosterone on prostate cancer and development and progression. And this was 22 randomized clinical trials for a 1 to 3 year period. And it found that administration of testosterone replacement therapy does not promote prostate cancer development or progression. And they say more long-term data needs to be done. They've even done studies with giving men that have prostate cancer testosterone because they were low in it, and it didn't promote their prostate cancer. Now, testosterone can increase prostate hypertrophy, but it's not something that's going to seem, doesn't seem to be anything that is a concern for actually causing cancer itself. Okay, and in some men, it can cause hypertrophy, so it needs to want to monitor PSA and so forth, especially as testosterone turns into DHT and estrogen. This was a study of 7 randomized clinical trials, 800 subjects, and they go on to show that testosterone therapy is not effective in increasing bone mineral density in older men, and it has limited effects on PSA. So the majority of men that go on testosterone replacement therapy don't have enlarged prostates. Majority of men don't have any major or any population-based statistical significance change in PSA, but it's still something that you want to check as a clinician. And then this was another study that was done, because the initial studies with testosterone found that were done in women showed that high testosterone was linked to cardiovascular disease. And if you look at that study, you realize that women that have high testosterone really have PCOS, which is an insulin-driven disease, which clearly causes cardiovascular disease. So they made the assumption that testosterone is bad for the heart. But in men, it has the opposite effect. And hypogonadal men that are treated with testosterone therapy have all their cardiovascular risk factors and their mortality risk and all-cause relative risk reduced. So this is what these studies show. And then this was another study looking at prostate cancer that didn't show any kind of reoccurrence of prostate cancer with giving testosterone replacement therapy with those patients with malignancy. And in hypogonadal men, it really improves quality of life and changes red blood cells and so forth. This was a New England Journal of Paper study. It was a placebo-controlled study, non-inferiority trial, 5,246 men to look at safety, cardiovascular safety. And this trial showed that there is no concerns with safety with men on testosterone replacement therapy for cardiovascular disease. One of the things you have to remember as a clinician is there's a lot of bias in the healthcare system that testosterone has a lot of dangers in men. And most of these large studies and clinical trials and meta-analyses have really shown bioidentical testosterone. And we're not talking about like anabolic steroids that the bodybuilders use, but bioidentical testosterone, where the therapy's goal is to get them in a normal male reference range and keep them in that reference range, mid, or maybe towards the higher end, but in that reference range, seems to be very safe. It doesn't cause all the concerns that were assumed that it may have because of steroid use. Okay. Now, there is some concern that red blood cells can get too high when men go on prostates. And there's some concern that they have hair loss. And there's some concern that some men may have prostate enlargement, benign prostate enlargements, but not malignancy. And these are the hair loss and prostates related to DHT. Typically, when people have androgenic alopecia, their DHT levels are high. And this can cause some degree of hair loss, and there's medications that are used. There's nutraceuticals that dampen 5-alpha reductase, the enzyme that converts testosterone to DHT. But you really have to be careful shedding on DHT unless it's pretty severe, because it's one of the most powerful androgenic effects in tissues, and you have to really consider if that's something you really want to do. The most effective thing that I've seen help men that go on testosterone replacement therapy that helps their hair is actually shampoos. And there are a couple studies done with shampoos, and grapeseed extract and rosemary shampoos seem to improve thinning of the hair in these men that have these responses, because it directly impacts the effects of DHT in the hair follicle. So the effects of androgenic alopecia is really on the hair follicle itself. So when they directly have rosemary and grapeseed extract shampoos put into their scalp and they massage it in, it seems to be something that a lot of men have reported benefits with, and some small studies that showed that it's beneficial. So it's something you might want to look up if you're working with a lot of men that may have this concern. Okay. Now let's talk about aromatase inhibitors. When men go on testosterone therapy, and especially if they start to show elevated estrogen levels, or if men have estrogen levels to being on testosterone replacement therapy, then aromatase inhibitors may be used. These are the most common aromatase inhibitors: Aromidex, Aromacin, Femvova. These are the generic names. And it's not uncommon today for many practitioners that use testosterone replacement therapy to put a male on some low-dose aromatase inhibitors, maybe right from the very beginning, but especially if their levels of estrogen levels start to go up. So the goal is to try to make sure that if they're on TRT, they're not starting to make higher amounts of estrogens. And the more body fat a person has, the more insulin surges they have, the greater potential for aromatization to happen, and these are where these aromatase inhibitors come in. Now, a lot of men over time, if their testosterone levels start to improve and they can start to exercise and get their body fat down, they may not even need to take any type of aromatase inhibitors. But testing is really critical to determine if that's appropriate. Okay, and then if a person, like you'll see bodybuilders a lot of times, they'll take way too much aromatase inhibitors, and it's just to get their estrogen levels down to nothing, so they want to get really cut and lean. And that comes with severe joint pain, brain fog, cognitive decline, emotional liability. Estrogens help collagen and joints to function. Estrogens are involved with synaptic activity. So brain function goes down, cartilage doesn't regenerate, and emotional dysfunction takes place. So those are indications that someone's abusing aromatase inhibitors or taking too much. You're never going to get that with natural compounds that have some effects on aromatase inhibitors, but natural compounds don't have nearly the strength that pharmaceutical aromatase inhibitors do. And then if someone has aromatization issues, if they go on testosterone replacement therapy, or they're just making estrogen high on their own, things like hot flashes, breast swelling, fluid retention, increased belly fat, emotional ability, and these are all signs that they may need to increase their aromatase inhibitor or decrease their testosterone, whatever the clinical scenario may be. Now, with men that do testosterone replacement therapy, which again, most men don't end up on creams, this has really become the standard approach to do it. There's different forms of testosterone, and intramuscular injections are the delivery method. And the two most common ones are testosterone cypionate and testosterone ethanate. And these have a half-life of about 7 days. So most men that go on TRT will start between 100 to 200 milligrams, usually typically more like around 100 per week. And this is bioidentical hormone. Cypionate is just the carrier. It's like thinking of it as bioidentical being carried by cypionate, just like testosterone can be bound by serum, sex hormone-binding globulin. People will get an injection of a dosage, let's say it's 100 milligrams, and then over the next week, that'll start to break down to bioidentical forms and so forth. And some men can handle weekly dosage. Some men will have to, they'll notice they don't function after a few days, and they may have to break the dose in half, so they do a dosage every 3.5 days. But typical injection dosages are done over a 7-day period, either with testosterone cypionate or testosterone ethanate. And then some people will react to one, have like skin rashes, they're reacting to the cypionate, which is more like of a grapeseed extract, versus the ethanate, which is a different filler. So those are the key ones. And then there's testosterone propionate, peaks in blood within hours of being administered, half-life is 3 days. This is where people start using it for muscle mass gains. In a clinical setting where the goal is trying to restore testosterone for physiology and health, usually people use testosterone cypionate and ethanate. Now, sometimes people use testosterone that doesn't have a carrier like cypionate. It's just testosterone itself, no esters to carry it. And this is used by bodybuilders right before they go to the gym and work out. They have a painful injection because these carriers prevent some of the irritation that causes the tissue. And they'll go in there and it requires an injection every 1 to 3 days. And some bodybuilders will get injection for each workout. They'll use testosterone suspended with no carrying agent, inject it into their muscles, deal with the pain, push it in there, go work out, and build muscle mass. That's how bioidentical testosterone is used without suspension. In medical clinics, trying to restore health, it's acetaminophen. That's actually the most common one that's used. Now, a typical protocol would be a man that needs testosterone replacement therapy is they get some injectable form of testosterone, usually like once a week, and they may or may not, depending on who they're working with and what the lab results show, also take an aromatase inhibitor to slow down the conversion of testosterone to estrogen. And they also will be given a dose of HCG once a week, injectable dose of HCG. And the reason you're given HCG is that the testosterone itself is going to suppress the pituitary. And since luteinizing hormone is not going to stimulate the Leydig cells, you're going to have testicular atrophy. And this can lead to lifelong infertility. They'll give men now with current protocols HCG at a low dose once a week, injectable, so that they can not have testicular atrophy and maintain their fertility. Like a male with low testosterone going in a typical testosterone replacement clinic is going to get some weekly dose of a bioidentical testosterone, maybe with or without an aromatase inhibitor, and then with a low dose of HCG. So they're giving themselves a weekly injection of HCG and a weekly injection of testosterone, or they're going to the clinic and they're doing it. And the aromatase inhibitors are typically oral tablets. Okay. When you're looking at the clinical approaches to treating men with low testosterone, low enough where they need to take replacement. And remember from the review of the literature of all the different natural botanicals that raise testosterone, their natural botanicals and compounds in all these clinical trials have only been shown to raise testosterone by 10 to 20%. So when you're looking at men that have testosterone levels like in the 200s or 300s, and they need to be like 400, 500, 600, 700 to be in the normal, healthy, ideal functional range where they don't have any symptoms of androgen deficiency, they may never be able to do it with botanicals. Testosterone replacement therapy may be one of the ways they can regain their health and function back. So symptoms of low testosterone, you can identify with the questionnaire forms. We talked about the ADAM questionnaire and the aging male symptoms questionnaire. These are validated forms. You definitely want to consider using these in your office. Even though you have the metabolic assessment form, having a quick questionnaire that's been validated really justifies that they have clear indications that have been substantiated associated with low testosterone patterns. And then the typical model is to measure total free testosterone. Obviously, you want to measure estradiol, estrone, estriol, FSH, LH, DHT. That would be the best scenario. But when you look at the current model for testosterone replacement therapy, the inclusion criteria is to look at total testosterone and see if total testosterone is below 400. Now, the lab range with most labs will be something like this. 264 to 916 is like the average laboratory reference range. But the guidelines that most people are using is levels of 400 are a concern. Okay? Now, or free testosterone less than 11. And the lab ranges for free testosterone vary between 6.8 to 21.5. But most physicians and people that do hormone replacement therapy will look at free testosterone levels anything below 11 as being an indication for treatment. Either one. Now, there's some exclusion criteria that are used today for testosterone replacement therapy. If the PSA is above 3, they're usually excluded from testosterone therapy, concerned that it may cause hypertrophy. And if their hemoglobin gets above 18 or is higher than 18, then they would have to cut down therapy. And if a male is on testosterone replacement therapy, one of the things that is always looked at is the hemoglobin, because red blood cells are stimulated by testosterone. And if the levels get above 18, they might have to cut down the dosage and see how they do. Okay, testosterone replacement is given with or without HCG. Like with some of these older men that don't really care if they have testicular failure and don't want an extra injection and don't have no plans of having children in the future, they may not use HCG. So HCG is used with younger men to maintain their testicular size and their fertility. Okay, once their levels are low, they have the inclusion criteria met. They don't have any exclusion criteria met. They go on testosterone replacement therapy. Then they're evaluated, let's say once a month or even weekly, of how their androgen symptoms are, and they should change pretty quickly. You should see a difference in symptoms within a week, no problem. The screen for prostate hypertrophy symptoms, then the labs are repeated every 1 to 4 months, maybe in the beginning every month or so, and they want to see the levels of testosterone within this level. Like most people that practice male hormone testosterone replacement therapy won't allow men to have their testosterone levels above the normal reference range. And that can allow them to be like 1,000, 1,500. That's borderline malpractice. That's where they can have some medical issues, medical legal issues by their peers and by medical boards if they get past that. The typical approach is to keep levels like in the mid-range, in the 500 or above range when starting the replacement, and make sure that their hemoglobin and PSA are not elevated. And at that point, once they go on replacement, they can either consider to stop therapy if it's not working for them, it's not functioning for them, they feel worse. They may want to add in aromatase inhibitors or increase the ones they are. They might have DHT level issues, and if their PSA starts to creep up and they start to have more hair loss, they may want to consider using some 5-alpha reductase issues, or they just may want to adjust the testosterone dosage. And typically, clinics will start like at the dose, like let's say 100 milligrams, and then every month they might, if it needs to be elevated, they'll go like around 20 milligrams at the most per month. Because if they overshoot testosterone and start with someone with 200 milligrams of testosterone, now the level's above 1,000, they'll have to wait for those levels to come down to avoid any issues. And men, when they get to that level, may feel great for a couple weeks, but if they sustain that level for a while, some of them may have this like hormone receptor downregulation and feel worse. So that's the typical approach for testosterone in men. Okay, so with young men, HCG, with men that still have concerns about their testicular size and don't want atrophy, they'll take ACG with bioidentical testosterone, and then aromatase inhibitors if they're needed. That's the current approach with testosterone replacement therapy. So key points about this, long-term testosterone therapy in men with testosterone deficiency improves body composition, quality of life. Long-term testosterone therapy in obese men with testosterone deficiency ameliorates all metabolic syndrome components. And long-term testosterone therapy in men with testosterone deficiency, with or without lifestyle modification, may prove very effective and useful in management of obesity. Now, I'm going to show you a case study of a male that was doing every single thing right for insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome. Nothing changed until they got on testosterone. As soon as they went on testosterone, everything responded. And that's one of the things you really want to be aware of. Men that have like diabetes, men that have long, struggling, depression issues, fatigue issues, difficulty gaining muscle mass, losing body fat, poor endurance issues. They feel like they're all washed up, can't do anything in life. That's actually a question on the questionnaire form. They think it's over, they should need to quit. Those are candidates to really have testosterone levels checked. And to simply add a total testosterone and a free testosterone on a routine blood test as a clinical workup is not that expensive. Okay. Then we get into the non-hormone model, dietary, nutrition, lifestyle. Remember, there's no standardized approach with diet, nutrition, lifestyle, and there's a lot of uniquenesses and approaches for it. There isn't like the nutraceuticals you take for optimal testosterone. There isn't the nutraceuticals you take for optimal menstruation or optimal menopause function. It really depends on the pathways that are involved. So in the course of four, we talked about different dietary strategies, and with the dietary strategies and nutritional strategies and approaches to looking at hormones, you always want to start with dietary and lifestyle strategies first. You'll have the biggest impact with these clinically. Now, you also have to remember, like, when you see a patient in your office and you want them to do a hormone profile, let's say you're ordering the test kit from the lab, they get the test kit, let's say, in a few days, or maybe you hand it out to them, depending on how you have your office set up. They then wait to do the test, and then they get the test results back. That could be like a two-week period. It can even longer. If you're waiting for a patient to do a 30-day hormone profile, they get the test kit, they wait till they have the first day of their cycle. Maybe it takes a couple weeks before they get back to the first day of the cycle. Then they start collecting hormones, or they collect saliva or urine all throughout their entire menstrual cycle for the next 4 weeks. They send it to the lab. The lab will take 2 weeks to get the results back to you. It could be like 2.5 months before you get any results. You could have fixed everything in 2.5 months. You could have like just fixed their blood sugar issue and the prostaglandin issue and not have to wait 2.5 months. Okay. In certain conditions, it just makes sense to just start treatment. Now, with simple tests, like just that isolated testosterone, like for andropause, that makes a lot of sense. But in any case, you want to like look at dietary and lifestyle strategies, especially as you're waiting for lab tests to come back. You can already implement a lot of things that are involved. Okay. And in, for me in my practice, I think when I first was doing functional medicine, I thought I was a better functional medicine or better clinician if I did more testing. That meant I was more thorough. That means I'm doing a better job. I'm not missing anything. And then over time, I've realized that's not really the best strategy. The best strategy is be efficient with the lab testing you do. Know how to prioritize when you do lab testing versus when you want to do some interventions. But even more importantly, I think it's best just to communicate with the patient. So sometimes I'll say, do you want to check all your hormone profiles now as a baseline and see where they are? Or do you want us to do some interventions that are really clear that could make impacts on your hormones for the first month or so and then check your hormones? Because we'll have to check those hormones after these interventions anyways. And then some people will say, no, I want to know everything now. I go, great, let's test it. Other people are like, no, I'm going to budget. Let's be the most efficient we can with everything. So you could have the first month you're working with a person and you're just trying to get their hypoglycemia under control. And then you check their hormones and see what's happening with them. And a lot of their chief complaints may be completely resolved. And the hormone, the profiles that really are the biggest concern are the female hormone profiles done over an entire month. Those just take so much time and energy to get back. But the simple, quick testosterone ones or menopause ones are not as difficult to get back. But when it comes to treatment, you want to have the application has the greatest effect. And I can tell you, for someone who's been doing this for over 25 years at a high level, like aggressive level, with really complicated patients, with really thorough workups, most hormone disorders are really related to underlying metabolic factors, physiological factors, and not so much specific to a nutrient deficiency. So you're not going to out-nutrition someone's endocrine disorder. You're going to have to figure out what key mechanisms are driving their imbalances. We kept talking about proteins and diet. So proteins are really critical. One of the things I found very useful in my practice that I'm using, because I have a lot of patients, probably like you do, that have autoimmunity, and they all want to use like protein powders. I found grass-fed beef to be a very good protein powder source. There's lots of companies now that make really good grass-fed beef protein powders. The scoop is 20 grams of protein. So you have some patients, they put in two scoops, mix it with some ice and water, got 40 grams of protein right there with a non-soy, non-pea, non-allergen-reacting whey kind of type of protein, just grass-fed beef protein. So I've been using a lot of grass-fed protein to get my patients' protein levels back up. That works really well. Animal protein is much better utilized by the body to convert into amino acids. So it's going to be really hard also with just a vegetarian diet to get those things to change. When you work with people that prefer to have a low animal protein diet, there's the ones that if you give them the grass-fed protein powder option, and again, there's grass-fed protein powders you can find on Amazon, online, lots of different manufacturers for them. And even just using collagen protein can be effective as well. And those can be very effective ways for people that don't really want to chew and eat a lot of meat, but really know that they're protein deficient and need to get some protein to their system. I wouldn't really go far with a patient with lots of labs if they had protein insufficiency issues and they weren't eating fats, because you're really just wasting time. And you're not going to see significant laboratory changes with these profiles, with these lack of protein issues and dietary fat issues. Now, fatty acids, you really want to look at their dietary intake. You don't want the egg white person. The egg white person needs to go away when it comes to hormones. You want the egg yolk. You want the fat. You want the EPA. You want the DHA. You want the prostaglandins in there. They're not in albumin, which is the white part. The white part of egg yolks is good for protein, but not good for fatty acids. Okay? Now, you really want to make sure people are eating butter, healthy butters, getting healthy amounts of animal fat in their diet. This is going to be critical. You're going to see a lot of people, if you do red blood cell essential fatty acid profiles, you're going to see a lot of people that are actually deficient in arachidonic acid. Okay? Especially if you're working with health-conscious crowd. And for most people in most functional medicine practices, over time, you don't get the general population. When you first do functional medicine, you get the general population where, what, diet soda is not good for me? You're like, no. But once you get the functional medicine crowd over a period of time, because those are the practice patients that come into your office, they may know more about lots of things than you do as a practitioner, because they're so health conscious. And you'll see, like, a lot of them are like completely avoiding all types of animal fat, or you're not getting adequate amounts of different types of healthy fats in their diet. Again, I don't do the measurements specifically for their dietary calories being less than 30%. I just want to see if they're getting fats in their diet. This panel really becomes useful, and you can support them with these panels. You have to use high-quality essential fatty acids, because a lot of the fatty acids people get at health food stores are terrible. I'm not here to recommend any specific brands or anything, but they're just oxidized, boiled fatty acids. They're not good fatty acids. Fatty acids, any fatty acid a person takes, you should chew it, and it should actually taste okay. If it tastes foul and bitter, it's rancid. You have to understand a lot of these supplements people are buying on online stores or outdated products. A lot of the things are coming in from other countries or produced in other places. There's a huge scandal that just showed up where the Italian mafia is not really releasing olive oil to the U.S. markets. They're releasing different seed oils that they churn green and they sell with the bottle with the Italian flag on it made in Italy. You really want to make sure people have high quality, good essential fatty acids from trusted manufacturers. And you should tell the patient, if they're taking a fatty acid like blackcurrant seed oil or flaxseed oil, have them bite into it. And if it tastes rancid or bitter, it's already bad. Because that could be all the difference too. They could be taking fatty acids, nothing's changing, because they're taking one that's actually pro-inflammatory at this point and not fighting the anti-inflammatory effects. Stabilizing blood sugar levels is critical. If you guys have been following cases I've been doing in the clinical mastership training program, where we have live cases, every month we have a new case, and then we've been following them up for a two-year period, you'll see we won't go anywhere with a lot of patients until we can teach them to get their blood sugar under control. There's no point to do anything else. We might spend the first 30 to 60 days just focused on that. This is phase one. We're doing phase one, then we're going to phase two, then we're doing phase three. And the just simple principles of not letting blood sugar levels drop and getting insulin surges under control and making sure they don't get nocturnal hypoglycemia makes all the difference. You as a practitioner have to make sure you emphasize that more than anything. Why a lot of people don't get well working with practitioners, even functional medicine practitioners, is because there's not enough emphasis on diet and lifestyle. They just get supplements thrown at them. Now, nutraceuticals are important. We talked about when you need to use them, but it's definitely not the place to start, okay? And then with lifestyle, these things do matter. Getting movement in, getting sleep in, making sure they don't have sleep apnea, those are real, real critical things. So you have to make sure your patients that have any kind of hormone imbalances can sleep. Sometimes, like in perimenopause, they'll have to go on hormones to be able to fall asleep. Sometimes you'll have to use things like peptides. Sometimes you have to use things like valerian root or other things to make them sleep. But what I've typically found with people who have a hard time falling asleep, sometimes if they have a lot of anxiety and their mind's going like crazy, if they can exercise, even on a bike or just go jump rope for 5 minutes or 2 minutes or whatever, right at nighttime, they burn off all their catecholamines and their mind calm down and they can go to sleep. You really want to make sure they're not having stimulant stress responses at night. They can't be on the computer or on the phone. And the thing is, they can't sleep. You go, how often are you on the computer? Oh, all day, all night. Can you stop? Really? Well, yeah, I can try it. And I come back a week later. It did work. Yeah, it works. The next thing, you're doing it. You're stuck on your own computer. And then you remind yourself, hey, I shouldn't do that. You try to close it, and it works for you too. Stimulation does impact our pathways. GABAergic pathways become really important. We'll go over some of those nutraceuticals. Music therapy, less than 60 beats per minute. Making sure blood sugar levels aren't too low at night. People that are in ketogenic diets, making sure they have ketones at bedtime. One of the most common things you'll see with people that have low adrenal function and they can't sleep through the night and constantly wake up and you can't really fix their adrenal glands and that's impacting their ability to have this compensatory gland to deal with the other imbalances they're having with their menstrual cycle and so forth, is nocturnal hypoglycemia. In those cases, they're just not eating enough protein and fat or frequent enough through the day, and then they just crash in the middle of the night. So sometimes we'll have patients like that have some, if they can tolerate nuts, some nut butter or almond butter right before they go to bed. That seems to help. Sometimes just taking like MCT oil or exogenous ketones themselves, so they can't handle the fat before bed. They just take like exogenous ketones as a supplement. That can help them get to the night and sleep really well. And those are pretty good shifts too. Okay. We talked about weighted blankets. This can be very helpful, help people calm down their endocrine system, white noise machines, mouth taping, nutraceutical support to GABA pathway. Without question, valerian root will have the greatest impact. If you get a high-quality valerian root, especially a liquid form of valerian root, that has a really nice effect on having an agonist effect on GABA receptors, and right before nighttime, it can be very helpful. It's not going to completely sedate someone and pass someone out, but it will help. Now, things like melatonin can help someone like sleep through the night, but they can also throw off their melatonin rhythm, so those are things you want to be aware of. You have to check your patients with hormone imbalances for sleep apnea and either get them on a CPAP machine, even a drop of 10% total body weight. In many studies, it's shown to completely reverse sleep apnea if they're overweight. And then any kind of anti-snoring mouth guard could be a step before they commit to a CPAP machine. But you really want to make sure that you discuss that, have them keep a journal of it, and monitor that throughout their care. Keeping journals on their blood sugar stability, keeping journals on their dietary intake of protein and fats, keeping journals on their sleep would be good ways for you to follow up with them. If you're checking up with them like every month to see how they're doing, without really emphasizing everything on the supplement protocol that they're taking. Okay? Because patients get so fed up of another handful of supplements or so forth. As a matter of fact, as a practitioner, I found if I just underplay that in the beginning and not focus on that at all and just focus on the other things that are really going to have the biggest impact, I build a lot of patient trust. I build a lot of focused goals with the patient and a more much more effective strategy to make differences for them. And then, you guys, with antioxidants and clearance of pathways, obviously we talked about improving the resiliency, nutraceutical support phase 1, phase 2 pathways. These are usually done with supplements. Insulin, we talked about, you're going to do this all the time. Now, in the Crosby Institute Diabetes Dysglycemia course that I put together, we talked about different levels of what people need to do to really get their blood sugar under control. And if someone has like very early insulin resistance patterns that may be causing their endocrine dysfunctions, if they can increase their fiber intake, reduce their simple sugars, decrease their carb loads, decrease their meal size, prevent late night snacking, that could be enough. For some people, they've already done that, it's not changing for them. And then for them, if they're not, it's not changing, one of the fastest ways to drop insulin is to get in ketosis. So when people follow a ketogenic diet, they're getting 60% or more of their calories from fat. Fat doesn't drive insulin. So when people are eating ribeyes and avocados and egg yolk and those types of foods, they're not getting that huge insulin surge. They're getting the protein and fat, which can also be very good for many people that have a hard time gaining weight and need higher fats and protein in their diet. But ketogenic diets drop insulin, so most people that are overweight tend to lose weight with it. And for those that are not getting enough fats in their diet, if they do that with high-protein ketogenic diet, that can be very helpful if they're underweight as well. Now, if that doesn't work, the next thing to add to this would be intermittent fasting with fiber. They can just sometimes just do some intermittent fasting, and then intermittent fasting with ketosis and high fiber may be really extreme. There's lots of nutraceuticals that impact insulin resistance patterns, but with some patterns where you have PCOS, fasting has to be one of the things that you have to consider with them. Now, in perimenopause, you can have people completely fall apart and hate you and send you really evil emails and stuff because the body physiology can't handle it because adrenal glands are already taxed and overworked. So whether they do a 24-hour fast, alternate day fast, these things just immediately drop insulin. So you could literally have a female patient that has severe acne and hair loss. They start doing some various types of fasting, or they do time-restricted feeding, where they're doing 10-hour eating window, 8-hour eating window, 4-hour eating window, and all of a sudden their acne clears up, and they do this for the first 2 weeks, and boom, first time they don't have PMS, have any menstrual cycle pains, and it's that impactful. So it could be one of the most powerful therapies to use in a practice when a person has insulin-related patterns. With hypoglycemia, the key thing is just to make sure they don't get shaky, light, and irritable to the point where they don't feel energized after they eat. And then with the adrenal glands, nutraceuticals become really supportive for them. But you really got to get their blood sugar under control. You got to get them to sleep, exercise, make sure they have healthy, supportive relationships. And for some of these people that have the abnormal cortisol awakening response, one of the things that can be very useful is to use a sunrise alarm clock. Remember with the adrenal profiles, when the cortisol levels don't go up in the first 30 minutes, A sunrise clock is set to whatever time the patient wants to wake up. Whenever the person wants to wake up, they set it. And the clock slowly starts to put out UV lights as if the sunrise is happening and helps to reestablish circadian rhythms. So they put it right next to their bedstand, and this is a really good way to do it. If their cortisol waking response is abnormal, one of the first things they have to do to reestablish this is within the first 10 minutes, get up and start to move and just get their heart rate up. They could just roll out of bed and just start doing some push-ups. They can do it with their knees. They don't have to be perfect. They can just start doing some air squats. But if they get their heart rate up in that first 10 minutes for a couple minutes, 1 or 2 minutes, that can really start to turn on their cortisol awakening response. And then another thing that immediately can help with the cortisol awakening response is glycyrrhiza licorice. So either topical creams or liquid extract is easier than taking a pill that takes time to absorb and digest. And caffeine. Caffeine can reset that cortisol awakening response, but within that first 10 minutes. So when people have really difficult times getting out in the morning and the cortisol awakening response is off their adrenal profiles, really consider having them use a sunrise alarm clock, immediately having some glycyrrhiza or even some caffeine from that first 10 minutes, like maybe like some iced coffee right next to their bed or some glycyrrhiza, and then boom, right away, get their heart rate up. And that doesn't mean that's their workout. That just means how they function first thing in the morning. Then they can go brush their teeth and start with the rest of their day. And then over a period of a few weeks, you can recheck that cortisol awakening response and then see if it's supportive. For biotransformation pathways, we talked about nutraceuticals. For estrogen metabolism pathways, and this could be like if a person's on estrogen patches, on birth control pills, men with aromatization, patients with hot flashes, fluctuating estrogen levels. Maybe you want to get them to metabolize into the 2,4-6-D metabolites properly, have proper methylation to clear them. You want to consider using things like selective estrogen receptor modulators. These become important. There's going to be a lot of women that have gallbladder issues. You're going to see a lot of perimenopause, postmenopause women really suffer with hormone-related issues and prostaglandin issues and not be able to digest fats very well. Because during that progression into perimenopause and into menopause, many of them will have their gallstones developed. And remember, hormones have to be cleared out by the liver by combining with bile and having bile ejection take place to get those hormone metabolites mixed with bile into the intestinal tract. So you, on the metabolic assessment form, you're going to see people that have gallbladder symptoms. The other thing you might see is people that have essential fatty acid prostaglandin problems, and they're consuming healthy amounts of fats, but you see gallbladder-related symptoms, gallstone symptoms, and they're just not able to produce enough bile to digest those fats. They don't always have to have gallstones. Sometimes they just get the sludge, and the sludge will obstruct their efficiency of releasing bile to have an effect. The key thing with gallbladder patients is 30 minutes of endurance exercise 5 times a week has shown in studies to dramatically help with thinning out sludge. And it's at this point, depending how severe it is, they have to get rid of fried fats, oils, fried foods, carbohydrates, sugars. They may have to increase their fiber intake. Drinking coffee has definitely been shown to help gallstone and thick sludge, causes the gallbladder contract and move, and that makes a huge difference with people that have thick sludge and gallstones. And then the thing you need to know about is one of the risk factors for developing gallstones is HRT, oral contraceptives. Estrogens themselves can be a major source for some women to have their bile turn into sludge and then eventually into gallstones. These strategies sometimes can be enough to make a difference for them so they don't get that sludge effect. And then nutraceuticals that can be very helpful if they're starting to get these gallbladder-related issues and not able to clear out their fat, their hormones through their detox pathways, through the liver-gut pathways, would be things like coffee, green tea, ginger, curcumin. Whether these are supplements or consumed, phosphatidylcholine, beetroot extract, taurine, vitamin C, omega fatty acids, if they can digest them. A lot of times when patients have these gallstone issues, they have to take digestive lipase enzymes. Lipase will help digest their fats. Silymarin, dandelion root, if it gets really severe, the most effective way to dissolve gallstones really quickly is supplemental bile salts. Those are available over the counter. But bile salts, if you take too much, it can cause increased bowel activity, give severe diarrhea. So you have to start with one tablet and then see how they feel and then go up and almost find out what dosage causes them to have diarrhea and then back off and then go from there. And over like a period of 2 weeks, the same dosage that they could tolerate is now intolerable and they stop. And many times all their gallbladder symptoms can dissolve, can go away. Just from some nutraceutical interventions for a period of time, avoiding fat and fried foods and so forth. But it's another pathway you have to be aware of when you're working with patients that have functional reasons why their gallbladder function is not effective. We went into this a lot of detail in the Crosby Institute gastrointestinal course. And also remember, statins, diuretics, antibiotics, spinostatin can all be factors that impact the gallstones. The microbiome is another key area you're going to have to obviously manage and treat with patients that have functional hormone issues. We went over lifestyle things and nutraceutical strategies to implement with them. As far as males go, we talked about all the different male pathways, primary, secondary hypogonadism. With men that aren't ready for testosterone replacement therapy, but their testosterone levels are a bit low, putting them in a really powerful anti-inflammatory protocol with lots of different antioxidants, spectrum antioxidants, may be a really good idea. Just got to see if their levels change with that. And then with people that have secondary hypogonadism, you may want to look for any of these factors that are there. Sometimes you just can't make a difference with these lifestyle changes, or you can't find the mechanism, and they're at the point where their health is really going to decline if they don't take testosterone replacement therapy, so they just go on testosterone replacement therapy. Now remember, testosterone replacement therapy has an effect, but if you can raise it naturally for some people, that'd be ideal. And we went over clinical trials with fenugreek and ashwagandha and tribulus, but they can raise things about 10 to 20%. And for some men, that might be all they need. And for some younger men, that may be all they need to shift everything in their favor and start to function much better. And by the way, for some men that have this pituitary hypogonadism pattern, they just take some HCG, like shots, for a month or two. Sometimes it completely fixes everything, and they're done, and their testosterone's back, and they just had something like they had stress or something suppressed their pituitary, and they take some HCG shots, which stimulates the pituitary, and after a few weeks of doing that, their primary pituitary function is no longer there, and they're back, and they're functioning again. So you'll see that sometimes happen with people that men that are under a lot of stress, or have like severe injury, or been on glucocorticoids for a while, and they have a secondary hypogonadism, primary pituitary issue. Like here, low LH, low testosterone. Sometimes HCG alone can make a difference for them. And sometimes you can try to deal with botanicals. And then we talked about sex hormone binding globulin issues. You got to look for the mechanism for those. And then we talked about natural aromatase inhibitors. They're not going to be nearly as powerful as the pharmaceutical compounds, but not everyone needs those aggressive pharmaceuticals. They can get a lot of benefits with taking some of these antioxidants that also inhibit aromatase. And then the cutoff range is 400. Typically now when you look at different associations, some men just have levels below that, which is where they would use the TRT. And then if they're converting testosterone to DHT, these are the lifestyle factors and that can be used for them. Now with puberty issues, let's get into different conditions now. With females that are dealing with puberty and gynecomastia, they're just not healthy. They're basically overweight, not getting enough sleep, eating too much sugar. That's the main issue. Okay, you really want to break that web with them. So here are the things to consider clinically with puberty abnormalities, of endocrine disorders. Okay, number one, rule pathology. Rule out medications that can cause it. Normalize body mass index. Optimize essential fatty acids. Reduce chemical exposures, optimize microbiome diversity, and optimize biotransformation. That would be an ideal scenario. Now, can you do that with some parents and kids? No. Some parents are like, my kid is not going to eat anything besides tater tots, and I can't stop him to play video games. I'm like, okay. Then do what you can. see what happens. There's no magical way to turn some of those things around. Now, PCOS is something we talked a little bit about. And we talked about nutraceutical protocols for them. And remember, there's this relationship between the gut and insulin signaling and high testosterone, and this vicious cycle that's related. And for a lot of these women that have PCOS, as they progress into different stages of insulin resistance, like in stage one, we say just exercise, let show down carbs. In stage two, really try to dampen inflammation. And this is where they have to go into potential ketosis and intermittent fasting. And that's really a common thing with them. I will prescribe a lot of supplements in PCOS and really encourage time-restricted feeding, intermittent fasting, and even a ketogenic diet to try to break them out of the PCOS pattern. And it may take 1 to 3 months to break them out of the pattern. And sometimes it's not enough. And there are cases now where I will refer out for them to get peptide therapy. And surmirulin, which is a growth hormone analog, can really have a huge impact on their insulin sensitization for the first time in their life, and it can really help them sleep. Semaglutide, which is a GLP-1 mimicking hormone, shuts down that whole vicious cycle between the adipocytes and insulin pathways. And then taking things like berberine, I think it's just as good as metformin, but some of them are already on metformin. A combination of really powerfully sensitizing the insulin receptor sites, using growth hormone stimulating compounds to improve insulin signaling, and then using GLP-1 mimicking hormones like semaglutide in their injectable tablets. That might be used in combination with ketogenic diet, time-restricted feeding to reverse it. And you're not going to be able to do it just with like alpha-lipoic acid by itself. Now, in studies, alpha-lipoic acid, myo-inositol have some benefits, but it's a really vicious cycle. And the more wound up it is, the longer it's been there, the more body fat the person has, the older they are, the more aggressive you have to be with that. Okay? And we talked about peptides. The other thing is just using peptides. Surmirulin is a peptide that stimulates growth hormone that can be used to stimulate just general endocrine function. And I think of it as a way of someone wants to start considering using hormones, but they're not completely there yet, and they don't have lots of severe deficiencies. They may start with the growth hormone stimulating peptide. Now, with growth hormone stimulating peptides, in order to be included, being eligible for treatment, what they typically do is they measure serum IGF-1 levels. They make sure, first of all, are they low? The range is usually 230 to 70. And most people don't have low levels unless they have a severe growth hormone deficiency. So they don't really meet that criteria. But if someone has normal IGF-1 levels within the 230 to 70 range, but they have symptoms of growth hormone deficiency, like inability to recover and repair tissues, increased body fat, decreased lean body mass, loss of vitality, loss of mental acuity, osteoporosis, that is another criteria that's typically used to see if they're a candidate for growth hormone stimulating peptides. And these are subcutaneous injections that are done usually at bedtime. These peptides, these growth hormone releasing analog peptides, they make you tired. So people usually do it right before bed and they get really good quality sleep. It's another thing that really helps people having sleep issues. The treatment disqualifications that they look for is if you have any active tumors or cancers, you're not giving anything that stimulates growth hormone, because growth hormone can activate those mass growths. And then if the IGF-1 is ever elevated, which it typically isn't unless you have some weird tumor or some genetic disease. So most people will qualify for it just based on symptoms and having levels of IGF-1 levels that are not abnormal, and they can do a trial period of them. And usually the first week, you'll notice almost everyone that goes on them, they're like, this is the best sleep I've had in years. Puts them into deep sleep, okay? And then week two, most people will notice that the recovery from workouts are much better. Week four, typical symptom is that their mental acuity is better. They notice some change in skin elasticity. And then like weeks 8 to 9, this starts to really impact the body composition, insulin resistance. And then some people are on it for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, whatever the case is. And then they're typically done like 5 days a week. You take 2 days off just to let the feedback system not totally adapt to taking the peptides. And it's like it's not nutrition, it's not hormones, but it's a way to stimulate the endocrine system. They have to be prescribed by a physician, either MDDO or naturopath in the state based on state laws. But they're getting much, much more popular, and it's something to consider. Just as a longevity thing as you get older as well. Okay. We talked about different peptides as well, but none of those are not really being used in clinical strategies. Now, with PCOS, remember, it's this vicious cycle and web, but peptides and ketogenic diets and controlling insulin and supporting the gut and microbiome diversity and overall health, they're all part of the thing that you need to break people out of it. The most common thing you'll see with infertility will be PCOS. And the most common thing you see that cause menstruating hormone imbalances in females will be PCOS. So you want those aggressive approaches. Now, PMS is very common. So in a clinical scenario, when you're trying to figure out what to do with PMS patients, you want to, number one, balance prostaglandins. So look at their dietary history, look at omega-369 levels, make sure you make some adjustments. Typically, the nutraceuticals that you'll typically need would be things like flaxseed oil, fish oils, even primrazole, black currant oil. Those are the most common used nutraceuticals. And if you're not even sure which ones, you can mix all these together. Use those as a protocol with some people. And then a lot of the times you'll see what people need to do in their diets with PMS is to increase things like olive oil, increase fish intake, increase or decrease butter intake. Usually with a lot of people, it's to increase it actually. Increase eggs, specifically the egg yolk itself. And then there'll be times with PMS where these dietary nutraceutical changes may not really make a big difference. And the main difference you're expecting to see is the cramping, muscle pain, vasomotor changes. And if those are still not changing, you definitely want to run a red blood cell central profile and then get a better assessment of what's happening with their fatty acid pathways. And then you can be specific on their recommendations that way. So in addition to supporting prostaglandins with people who have PMS, you want to stabilize blood glucose levels. So see if they're hypoglycemic, see if they're insulin resistant, maybe they have a little bit of mixed patterns. Diet to stabilize their blood sugar, nutraceuticals like we've given in the list. And then you might want to run an adrenal profile, see what's happening with their adrenal glands. And maybe you need to support their cortisol awakening response. And then if you do an evaluation with their blood sugar and adrenals, do your dietary history. And then if they're hypoglycemic, see if their diet justifies them being hypoglycemic. If they're missing meals, eating simple sugars for meals. And if it does, then really start with their diet. That's a way to and support their adrenal glands to get them to recover. And if their diet doesn't justify them being hypoglycemic because they're not eating simple sugars and missing meals all day, then you're really thinking about something that's causing adrenal gland exhaustion, hidden infections, something driving their endocrine system, something driving their physiological stress response, and that's how you have to approach it. And then with people with insulin resistance, same thing. Look at if you see insulin resistance patterns, their dietary history with their symptoms, and then you do a dietary journal. If they're eating carbs and sugars all day and lots of sweets, snacking all the time with sweets and sugars, you can expect them to be insulin resistant. But if their diet's really clean, they're not eating any carbohydrates or very limited amounts of carbohydrates, you might suspect that cortisol levels are high. So you got to figure out what's driving their physiological stress response. So there's always this interconnection between adrenals and blood sugar disorders, which you have to find out as a clinician. Is it primary adrenal or primary dietary? And then adjust your treatment that way. Okay. Then you get your patients that have amenorrhea, oligomenorrhea. So they have missed cycles or they've lost their menstrual cycles. So right off the bat, number one, clinically, you have to rule out PCOS. You have to rule out PCOS. Elevated testosterone or DHA in the follicular luteophase. Any kind of hormone profile you run, if you run a urine profile or male salivary profile, a serum profile, anytime you see spikes of DHA or testosterone in a female, you've got to think about PCOS. Or even just sometimes if you see patterns of insulin resistance metabolic syndrome, you suspect that they just may have PCOS even without seeing their other hormones. And they always rule out that they're not hypothyroid. These things, PCOS and hypothyroidism, can be the direct cause for amenorrhea and oligomenorrhea. Now, with missed menstrual cycles, loss of menstrual cycles, you got to make sure they're not caloric deficit. You got to look at the total calories they're consuming. Body weight times 15 should be the minimal total calories. So if someone weighs 150 pounds, they should be eating at least 2,250 calories per day. Evaluate their protein intake, 1 gram of protein for each pound of body weight. So if they're 150 pounds, make sure they're getting 50 grams of protein. Evaluate their dietary fat intake, minimum of 30% calories from fat. If a person is 150 pounds and they're 2,250 calories, 30% of that will be their fat calories. They need at least 675 calories from fat. Like that's your first thing you should do with anyone who has missed menstrual cycles. After you've ruled out PCOS and hypothyroid. And they could have a combination of both. More than one thing. PCOS, some hypothyroid in, some dietary things. And then if these things are all intact, you got to make sure you don't have any malabsorption syndromes. Most common ones are celiac disease, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis being autoimmune intestinal diseases. You can measure ASCA-ANCA antibodies to see if they're there. And they'll usually have history of bowel urgency and uncontrollable bowel issues and chronic inflammatory gut issues as well. And then evaluate their adrenals and blood sugar. Typically, they're like the hypoglycemic, low cortisol person, low blood perfusion, all that stuff. So if you can get the dietary intake, caloric intake in, protein intake in, dietary fat intake in, stabilize your adrenal blood sugar levels, you're gonna fix like most of these people. They're not that hard. Some will just be like hypothyroid, no one identified it. It's typically Hashimoto's, but those are not hard cases. Okay. Menorrhagia, I should also put in here, adrenal, like overtraining syndromes can be a factor with this because it just really puts a lot of stress on the adrenal system. Okay. Menorrhagia, natural strategies, natural. Okay, so let's talk about people that have increased heavy menstrual cycle bleeding and so forth. So once again with this, rule out PCOS, rule out hypothyroidism. And if they have an impaired hepatic biotransformation, like all these symptoms here we're going to talk about in these boxes, you can pick up on from the metabolic assessment form. If they have impaired hepatic biotransformation, they may not be able to clear out their estrogens, so they have excessive estrogen thickening of the urine lining, so they have excessive bleeding. Any kind of dysglycemia, adrenal dysfunction can throw off their estrogen progesterone imbalances. Look at the metabolic assessment form for adrenal symptoms and hypoglycemia insulin resistance patterns. Prostaglandin imbalances can cause abnormal shedding of lining to the point they have increased menstrual cycle bleeding. Again, your prostaglandin intake. And typically with this one, it's like they're not getting enough fats and butters and other things in their diet. Okay? And then progesterone insufficiency can be in the follicular phase can cause that. So be aware of that. And then excess estrogens or endocrine receptors can cause that. So this is like your main list you want to think about with heavy menstrual bleeding. Now in perimenopause, remember they go into this inflammatory cascade. The key things you want to think about in perimenopause is hormone replacement therapy if symptoms are severe or if the patient just wants to be on it. Like for me, I've learned over the time, I'm not going to decide for you. You tell me what you want to do. I'm here to give you all the options I know about. You tell me what you want to do. I'll give them my opinion. Do you think I should go on the one my insurance covers or do you think I should go on Bidenical? I go, I think you should go on Bidenical. It's just a matter of cost for you. What do you want to do? Do you think I should be on them? That's something for you to decide. There's risks associated with it. And maybe your family history has this risk. That's something for you to consider. Maybe it doesn't, but it's really important. I think what happens to a lot of practitioners, especially the practitioners that do HRT, hormone replacement therapy, they want everyone on it. They think everyone should be on high dose. And I can see why, because they see so many people get benefits from that. But you got to be careful not biasing your patients too much and just making sure they get informed information from you and go over the approaches they need. So with perimenopause, ideal scenario, they work with someone who measures their hormones, and then they get a compounding pharmacist to make him a custom blend associated with their specific imbalances for them. Okay? Estrogen receptor modulators would be a good idea. Optimizing adrenal function dysglycemia is a common theme with all endocrine disorders. They're going to be prone to developing adrenal imbalances as they go through the stages. Optimizing microbiome diversity, diverse diet, butyrate fiber is going to be a key thing. Prostaglandin imbalances, anti-inflammatory support, those are all the main things you want to consider there. And then with andropause and menopause, just as men and women get older with their hormone deficiencies, we really want to think about the things we talked about, which is cognitive health, like healthy fats, anti-inflammatory lifestyle, exercise, cognitive tasks, cognitive nutraceuticals. So I would really suggest the Crosby Institute Cognitive Decline course to really get into deep details about that. But if you're working with older patients that are in the andropause, menopause stage, you really want to know exactly how to find subjective cognitive decline, mild cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's, and then all the different pathways that impact degenerative pathways, but it becomes an important area. Bone health is really critical. Hormones, vitamin D, anti-inflammatory protocols are very useful for that. Once they get older, calcium does very little for bone health. It's really more about hormones, vitamin D, and anti-inflammatory approaches. Reduce systemic inflammation. Be very good at doing a cardiovascular workup. And then the other key thing is optimize expression of longevity genes. And we did a whole course on longevity that goes into all the research. And this is also important when we talk about the concept of senescence. So one of the things you all need to make sure you know a lot about if you're working with patients in a functional medicine model is this field that's completely ignored in functional medicine, not completely ignored, but typically ignored, which is called geroscience. And geroscience is the physiology or the science of the physiology of how aging changes in telomere lengths and mitochondrial dysfunction and epigenetic alterations and senescent cells is really what causes diseases over a period of time. But there's certainly what causes cells to become senescent and people get physiological aging. When you look at how fast someone ages, what kind of endocrine organ reserves they have, they typically have decreased expressions of things like inflammaging and stem cell exhaustion, so they can really maintain their endocrine system. And ultimately, when you look at the things that impact, like the whole aging pathway, these are some of these cells, it all comes down to hormesis. The key concept of anti-aging and maintaining vitality and having your cells function for you as you get older throughout life and having your own healthy functioning endocrine system is to do things that build hormesis or builds resiliency. Things that are difficult, they stress out your system, but if you do too much of them, they can be harmful. Like exercise is a great example of that. Exercise is beneficial, but if you overtrain, then it becomes harmful. Typical things that are done in longevity medicine are like, this is where saunas come in, heat to the point it causes stress to the system. Lots of benefits with sauna, having anti-aging effects, longevity, turning on longevity genes. Cold plunges have become really popular. Cold plunges cause things like cold shock proteins to be released. They turn on a lot of mechanisms that impact things like protecting the genome, reducing inflammation pathways, changing epigenetic regulation, reversing even DNA damage that's being done. But the goal is to get hormesis. So resilient. So you want to engage in those types of things throughout your life to really optimize aging. The people you see that are like 70 and still healthy and doing everything, and still playing sports and skiing and running a business, they're the ones that are cognitively active. They're always learning and doing things. They're not just watching YouTube all day. They're learning new skills. They're interacting with people, having lots of social interactions with people, and they're doing a lot of physical activity and movement. And then they're building the resiliency pathways. That's like the main thing. When people stop doing those things, they're like behind a chair all day and not interacting with people, and they're not stressing their system, pushing them through resiliency stages, putting themselves in the cold temperatures, hot temperatures, getting their heart rate up. That's when you start to have significant aging that takes place. We talked about this in the longevity course, about this concept of resiliency. There's all different types of resiliency. If you want to know how fast you're aging and how fast you'll probably have your endocrine system fail on you, just look to see how you are with pathogen resiliency, immune resiliency, dietary resiliency. So if you can't handle cold like you used to, you're reacting to every single food like never before, you can't handle stress anymore, those are all signs you're losing resiliency, which means your geroscience pathways of aging are accelerating. As you lose resiliency, you're definitely turning on these aging pathways.
You can find all of this information and more at drknews.com/podcast. There you'll find the show notes, readings, and links related to this episode. You can also find Dr. Karazian's blog at drknews.com. The best thing to do is sign up for his weekly newsletter, where he will update you on the latest research and clinical strategies related to chronic and autoimmune health conditions. On social, you can find him on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest with the username Datis Karazian. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional health care services, including the giving of medical advice. And note, no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to the podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not delay or disregard obtaining medical advice for any medical conditions they have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. To learn more about Dr. Karazian's disclosures and the companies he advises, please visit drknews.com/about.